Accession number 27302, Reel 8.
Mr. Dobbs, Reel 8. We've talked about one or two actions that you were in since you joined the 10th and then to the 9th Battalion, Mr. Dobbs. And you were a corporal at that time.
Yes.
So how important were the, or what were the leadership qualities you felt, or you feel, that a corporal leading a number of men should have?
That's a difficult one. It's you're expected to lead and to consider the welfare of your men as much as possible, to keep them out of danger wherever you can, and to lead with a good example. Sometimes you have to cheer them up when they're depressed and frightened in some cases, because sometimes your fellow said, "Oh, I was not frightened, never afraid." Personally, I don't think they was ever in action, or they're a damn liar, because everybody gets frightened in action. But once you're in action, it's not so bad. It's the thought, what's going to happen before you go in, the anticipation of what you're going to meet.
So your training takes over, in effect.
Oh yes, yes.
And your role as leading this men was always that a frontal role, obviously?
More or less, yes. You were leading the section all the way.
So the pressure upon you to show no emotions
well,
or
well,
fear...
Well, that's true, because your section looks to you for leadership and advice and all that sort of thing.
You mentioned that you know, some men who said they were never frightened, and your own opinion was that all men were, in effect, to some degree. Did you ever have an experience where there was a member of your particular section who wouldn't move, who froze?
No. But I heard of a case where we were briefed to make an attack, and we were told that there was five lines of Germans laid up in front of us. I don't know where they got the information from, but there was one little chap. They reckon he put the rifle under his arm and he blew his hole through his shoulder. He was so terrified of what was going to happen. He wasn't in my section, but I'm told that's what happened to him.
But occasionally this kind of thing did happen.
Yes.
The sight of dead and wounded men on a battlefield, as you say, you couldn't stop to attend to them. You weren't allowed to, were you?
You've got to keep moving, yes.
After the battle is over, after the action is over, did you have any role in collecting the wounded and the dead?
Well, the party that was following behind, they took over that role, really, because... we were always dug in when we go forward after the battle. You didn't come back. You dug in where you were to maintain that ground.
So presumably the medical men, stretcher bearers and so forth, were following you?
They were, yes, but very often we never saw them because we were so far in advance of them. Maybe two or three days before they would come up and collect the dead and that, dealt with the wounded.
You must have seen some... terrible things,
yes,
are happening to men close to you, even in your own section.
Well, yes, I've seen men shot right next to me. That was at Ibn Biberon.
Which we'll come to.
Yes.
What was the men's reaction towards enemy mortar fire?
It was very frightening. The Germans, they had...
Minenwerfers or something.
That's right, Minenwerfers. It was a multi-barreled mortar. And when they set them off, they used to scream. Terrifying sound. We used to nickname them Moaning Minnies. Yes.
Do you drop to the ground when you hear them coming?
Oh, yes, you ought. Well, you got undercover somewhere. Because they would... drop in a circle, more or less, not in one particular spot, you see. So they covered a wide area with all these shells going off from the mortars.
What is the feeling when you're flat down on the earth and these things are dropping around you? Is there a kind of a strong feeling to scrabble your way into the earth?
Well, you try to get below the surface of the ground if you can to protect yourself.
It must have been extremely difficult when men that you knew so well had been hit.
Yes.
And were
yes.
shouting.
Yes.
Or crying.
That's right.
And how do you deal with that?
Well, you couldn't stay to attend to them. You had to keep going forward, depending on the situation, you see. There was a case when we were going along a ditch to attack a farmhouse. Now, this was in Holland. There was water in the ditch, in the bottom of the ditch, but we had to crawl along as best we could. And there was no gates there as such, like hedges and gates. It was just a ditch and then a little bridge with a gate on top. And I remember we had to go along, crawl along this trench, jump up out of the trench and dive across the road and down into the trench on the other side. And we did that, and I remember I performed this operation, jumping across the road like and landing in the ditch, and a fella come behind me. He said, "Bah, you were lucky there," he said. "That sniper's bullet just missed your arse. It landed in the bank behind you." So we continued along this trench and getting nearer to this farmhouse. And I was nudged in the back. And one of the lads said, "Jack, I've been hit." And I turned around, and all the front of his chest was covered in blood. He'd been shot through the throat. Narrowly missed his windpipe. That was another one of our Welsh lads. We called him Smudger Smith. I don't know what happened to him after that, because we sent back along through the section to try and get the stretcher better forward. But I never saw Smithy after that. And we were pinned down in this trench. And I remember eventually a Churchill tank came up, one of ours. It was a flamethrower. And he put a few bursts of flame into this farmhouse. And we never heard no more from the firing from there after that.
What are the usual cries of a wounded man when he's hit and falls?
Well, I never heard any squealing or shouting, you know. They would flop down and gasp, and they would realise that they'd been hit.
So many people say that the initial thing is to cry for the mother.
Well, I never witnessed that myself, like. But,
feeding on the battlefield, obviously you can't carry a great deal of supplies with you. You'd have some form of iron rations.
Oh, yes, you had your haversack rations, that they called.
What were they?
Mostly bully beef, pardon me. Biscuits, hard tack, we used to call.
And
we had the water bottle for liquid.
Could you eat those when you wanted to?
Oh, yes, yes, more or less, yes. And if you were lucky at night time, or after the battle was over and things calmed down, sometimes the fatigue party would come forward with dixies of soup and that sort of thing. So it was quite good that way.
Taking enemy prisoners of war, what was the initial procedure? Let's have a situation where you probably were in, where there was actually men surrendering
yes,
to you.
Yes, well.
What's the procedure?
As in Eben Buren, we'll come to that later.
Oh, we can leave that then.
Yes.
Come to that later. But the presumably the thing is that you didn't harm them in any way.
Oh, no.
Were you given general instructions on how to deal with prisoners of war?
Well, as I say, we will come to that in a moment. What action I took on this particular occasion.
I'm thinking in terms of, you know, where you said you were told when if you take a prisoner of war, do you search them first, or what was the,
well,
the general procedure rather than any particular action that you came that you
well went? The first thing that you do is you make sure they haven't got any weapons on them. That was the main part, really. And then you would keep them in a bunch until you could get them back behind the lines, back into your own lines.
Mr. Byron, they must have been pretty frightened.
They were. They didn't know what they were coming into.
Were personal effects taken off them? Rings, watches, what have you?
There was in some cases. I never did that myself, but there were in some cases. But the things that we used to take was if they had any Luger pistols on them. That sort of thing, we used to take them. But some of the lads used to take watches from them, but I never did that myself.
How clever were the Germans at booby-trapping?
Oh, yes. They were, well, they would put a booby-trap underneath a dead soldier's body. You know, the likes of... I've seen us going down a lane and come across two British soldiers. They had been on patrol the night before, and they'd got killed. And there were booby traps placed under them. They were up to all kinds of tricks like that, you know. In the end, they were so desperate that they were laying these teller mines just anywhere. They wasn't bothering to cover them up because they didn't have the time to do that. They laid them just willy-nilly, sort of. Put a few old dead leaves over them, hoping that a tank would run over them.
Yes, they had a large anti-tank mine, aren't they?
Yes, they were about the size of a dinner plate, I would imagine, about 3 inches thick. They were called telemine.
Was it safe for an infantryman to walk across them if they were
unburied? No, it wasn't safe to. It wasn't safe to go onto them, no.
What was the main anti-personnel mine that you came across?
Well, I never witnessed one of them myself, but I'm told that they were small canisters, and if they were triggered off, they would jump in the air and explode about 3 foot from the ground, and the shrapnel would cover a wide area.
Very unpleasant.
Very unpleasant, yes, yes.
Snipers, you've mentioned snipers on a number of occasions.
Yes.
Was a situation reached where they knew that they couldn't do any more? Did they surrender?
In some cases, yes. Yes, when things got too warm for them, they surrendered. But they were desperate little devils, some of them. They were young fellas, just come out of out of the training schools. And you would get them shouting, "I want to die for Hitler," that sort of thing. They were so determined.
And snipers were not obviously well liked.
Oh, no.
Was there a tendency to be pretty rough with them when you caught them?
Well, I treated them like any other German prisoner of war. But some people, they did give them a rough time, like.
And you were saying that these were pretty fanatics.
They were fanatics, yes. Of course, they were very difficult to spot because they were digging what they call a foxhole, which is a hole about 2 feet wide and go straight down about 6 foot. And there were cases where they used periscopes to see the surrounding area instead of them having to expose their heads above ground. And they were up to all kinds of tricks. They would even lash themselves to a tree up among the branches. Very difficult to spot.
And getting them down from the tree, when you were in effect...
Well, they used to fall out if they were fired upon.
They came down pretty quickly.
Yes.
Now, we've got now to the next move that you made, which would be around about Saint-Just.
Yes.
In January. What are your memories of that?
That's action? January the 25th. Oh, that was the time when I just mentioned about crawling along the ditch to this farmhouse.
which we've got, that's fine.
Yes.
The Sanjivs itself was a village or a town of some kind, some size.
Yes, but we were more or less in the country, you know, on the outskirts of it. Where isolated farms and that sort of thing.
It was quite a violent action, though, round that.
Yes, it was pretty busy there, yes. St. Deuce, yes, I've got in my little diary, I've got 3 question marks which donated very heavy firing, a very serious action sort of thing. I didn't have time to write the full story down.
Did you get involved in house to house?
Yes, yes, I'll come to that in a few moments. After Posterholt, we came out of the line for a rest, and the battalion was billeted in a large wood. We had to make little bivouacs ourselves. We used to join our gas capes or ground sheets together to form a little tent just for 2 of us to get under cover. And I remember we, after we built our little bivouac, I heard that some of my mates that was with me in the 10th Battalion, and they were Welsh lads, I heard that they were in A Company down at the end of the woods. So I sneaks off down and had a chat with them. And on the way back, who should I bump into was C Company commanding officer, company commander, Captain Ashton. He said, "What are you doing here? Who will give you permission to leave your area?" I explained why I went away to see my lads, see my mates rather. But he still put me on a charge. So I was up before Colonel Mogg. And he said, "How long have you been a corporal?" I said, 3 years, sir. He said, 3 years, that's a long time to hold one rank. He said, "I intend to go on to become a field marshal." I thought, his ambition is very high, like. But he went on to become a general later on, which was very a remarkable step to achieve. Anyway, he said, "Why did you leave the area?" I said, "Well, some of my mates who had joined up with me in 1940 was in A Company, and they were stationed down at the other end of the wood, so I went down to see them. And on the way back, I met Captain Ashton, and that's why I'm on a charge." So he said, "I see on my desk that you request an interview with me after I've dealt with your case." I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "What do you wish to speak about?" I said, "Well, with your permission, I would like a transfer from C Company to A Company to continue soldiering with the pals I joined up with in 1940. I said, "We were split up when we came to your battalion." So he said, "As regards your charge," he said, "I'm taking into account the fact that we've all been through a lot of action lately. But," he said, "for leaving the area without permission, I have to reprimand you." Now, he said, "About this transfer," he said to Captain Ashton, "are you prepared to let this man go from your company?" Ashton said, "Yes, sir." And he said to Captain Peter Thompson, company commander of A Company, he said, "Are you prepared to have this man in your company?" "Yes, sir." Well, he said, "In that case, the request is granted." So a couple of days later, Captain Thompson came along with his jeep and picked me up and took me and my kit back to his company, and we got on very well.
Which platoon did you join there?
I joined 9 platoon, yes.
And the platoon officer, do you remember who he was?
Not at the moment, I can't, no.
And was this before Saint-Just or after it?
This was after St. Just, yes.
To go back to St. Just, you were telling me of the of having problems in a house where you got trapped and you had to knock.
That's right, yes.
Can you put that on tape?
We were going down this road, and there was a long row of houses on the left-hand side of the road. And the back of the houses were all open ground. The right-hand side of the houses was a road and more open ground. And as we got towards the end of the row of houses, we come into heavy fire from the Germans. So we dived for cover, and we had to force our way into the last house. The Germans were situated in such a position that they had covering fire on both the front and the back of the houses, so we couldn't get out. And some of our lads was wounded. So one of the lads of the section went down into the cellar, and he came back with a sledgehammer. And he knocked a hole through each of the dividing walls between each house along the whole row. And that was the only way we could get back and bring our wounded men back with us. Yes, it was very worrying at the time.
So after you joined A Company, what happened to you then? What followed this?
I was automatically put in charge of a section. So shortly after I joined A Company, I began to get strange feelings in my stomach and that, and my skin was turning yellow. I went to the MO and he sent me to the hospital at Eindhoven, which was in military hands by them. So I was there for about 8 days being treated for yellow jaundice. Then I returned to the company, which was back in the line. Then I remember the first task I had to do when I rejoined the company was to go out on patrol one night with my section, a listening patrol, just to see if there's any Germans in the woods. Well, we never heard any movement or sound of Germans, but in the middle of the night we heard the sound of a train pulling a heavy load, chug, chug, chugging away. And when we came back off that patrol, I mentioned it to the officer. And he looked at his map, he said, there's no railway lines here. What had happened, we found out later, was the Germans had put a loudspeaker up in the trees to give an impression that there was a railway nearby. And there was no railway at all.
And presumably that was to give the impression that, you know, that they were moving, was, reinforcements.
He was trying to confuse you that there was a railway nearby, but in actual fact there wasn't in that spot. And after that we crossed the Rhine on the 25th of March.
What's your memories of crossing the Rhine? Because that was one major obstacle.
Yeah, well, we went over. We weren't the initial assault troops. We went over on a pontoon bridge, which was a series of boats lashed together and planks on the top to form a makeshift bridge, and that's how we went across the Rhine.
Were you under fire? Yeah. Were they shelling it?
There were shells coming over, yes. And we edged our way forward to the town of Borken and Verseka, if that's the correct way to speak it, W-E-R-S-E-K-E. And we advanced under what they call a creeping barrage. That's shells from our artillery landing about 100 or 200 yards in front of us. And as we moved forward, the shells, the artillery was elevating their guns to throw the shells further on. And we kept moving forward that way, and that was called moving under a creeping barrage. at Vasurka. We got into the village there, and we got into some damaged houses. And after a while, we heard the sound of motor transport coming. And we kept quiet. And it was an ambulance, a German ambulance. And he was followed by a motorbike and sidecar. But in the sidecar was mounted a machine gun. And the fellow in the sidecar was the machine gunner. Well, we let the ambulance through, but the motorcyclist and his companion didn't get through.
You fired on them?
Yes, yes. I think they had a shock, because they didn't realize that we were in the village. After we left Vasurka, we went into an open field. The whole battalion pulled in there. And the tanks, they all pulled into a rendezvous in the right-hand corner of the field from the gateway, as we looked at it then. And we, the infantry, occupied positions around the hedges at the far end of the field. And after a while, we heard the sound of a Jerry tank coming. It was two Tiger tanks, and they had the nerve to come into the field where our tanks were. And they opened fire, and our lads were firing back at them, but the shells from our tanks were bouncing off the Tigers just like pea shooter, you know. And every time that a shell came from the Tiger tank, it set one of our tanks on fire. It was a horrible sight to see them, what we called getting brewed up, going on fire. And the tank crews were jumping out of the tanks with their clothes on fire and dropping down dead on the ground beside their tracks. And it was a hell of a sight to see blackened, burned bodies, you know, unrecognizable. And the smell of burning flesh was terrible. I can still smell it, as a matter of fact. Hell of a smell.
Did you not have anti-tank weapons with you as an infantry unit?
Well, we were at the far end of the field, you see. We were away from this, and it was such a terrific bombardment going on between our tanks and these Germans. It wasn't safe to lift your head above the ground from the shelter we were taking. It was only after the Germans had done their damage that they pulled away out of the field and went back to their own lines. But the amount of damage that they had left behind was incredible.
As a unit, though, did you have an anti-tank gun?
We had anti-tank guns. They were with the tanks down the bottom end of the field. Yes, but they would have been of no use against a Tiger tank.
What caliber of anti-tank gun did you have?
We had... they fired... a shell similar to the size of a cigar.
Well, this is the boy's anti-tank.
That was the old boy's anti-tank.
I thought that by now it might have been replaced by the Piat. Do you remember the Piat?
Yes, the Piat, we had that, but there was a Piat section, but they weren't with us, you see.
What happened next?
I'm trying to think now. When the Tiger tanks pulled away, things quietened down, and then on the following day, we saw some typhoon planes, our own typhoon planes, going over, and they were strafing, bombing the area where these tanks were. And that was a tremendous sight, seeing them swooping down and dropping their bombs and then swooping back up into the sky. It is a wonderful sight.